Well, Father, as we come before you, Lord, we ask that you would open the eyes of our heart, God, that you would help us to understand your words, God, that we might live them out. And when it comes to this book of Revelation, God, I just pray that you would give us humility, give us passion, God, and give us your understanding, that we would be encouraged by this book. In Jesus' name, amen. It's really hard to imagine a book of the Bible that has more controversy, more debate, more discussion, more movies made about it, more books written about it, more blogs, more kind of just an uproar generally in Christianity than the book of Revelation. Historically, this has been the case, that over the 2,000 years since we've had this book, that church fathers, that church members, that pastors, church leadership have disagreed throughout the ages on what exactly this particular book means. In our own time, sometimes we may feel like we can't get away from the book of Revelation. The Left Behind series, the fictional novels that were made about it, were a bestseller. You found them crossing over into the secular world. You see them in bookstands, in Borders, and Barnes and Nobles, and again, on the websites that sell books. That has been extremely popular, the author's view of the end times that's portrayed in a fictional way through their novels. Again, now even made into movies. We see different movies, whether they be ones that are made by Christians or ones that are made by non-Christians, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, profess to give us some type of view of the time of the end, the time that Jesus will return, and again, giving us their take on certain things that are discussed in this book of Revelation. Even in the grocery store checkout line, we can't escape from the book of Revelation and the time of the end. As you go through the cheap tabloids that are there, you see things like Dead Sea Scrolls reveal the future, economic collapse coming in August, Jesus Christ returns to earth this fall on the exact date the world will end. World's top prophets weigh in on the time of the end. Prophecies, startling truths from the world's most respected religious leaders. And you'll see titles like War in America, Nuclear Hell on Earth, Rise of the Antichrist, Death of Billions as the World Ends. That really, even in these grocery store tabloids, you see this desire that we have first to know the future. That in a time of uncertainty, we even more want to know what things can we expect at the end of time. And you have non-Christians and Christians buying these magazines that will have things about, you know, what Billy Graham says about the end times and the four horsemen of the apocalypse right next to, again, an article about the face of Jesus appearing on a potato chip, or about, again, some 50-pound baby born in Hoboken. That there's this desire to know the future. And that has even more fueled speculation and interest in this book of Revelation. The sad thing is that the more that I talk to people about this particular book of Revelation, the more that there's two common responses that I seem to get from people after they read this book or as they study this book. The first is just that they're struck by the weirdness of the book. I mean, we've got beasts with many horns. We've got angels flying around. We have guys eating scrolls. We've got diadems. We've got swords coming out of people's mouths. I mean, the whole book, basically the symbolism, the pictures that are in there tend to be so different from the rest of the New Testament that people just don't know what to do. Christians don't know what to do with this book of Revelation. The other response, though, and this is the one that's even more troubling to me, is that people have a sense of fear that comes to them, either through this particular book as they read it, or through the movies, or through the fictional novels that they read, that it basically, in the end for them, promotes a type of fear of the time of Jesus' returns. That as they think about Jesus' return, it's not so much a joyous thing, but it's a thought about how persecution is going to increase. There'll be wars, there'll be earthquakes, there'll be famines, there'll be these many-headed beasts, whatever they particularly stand for, that all those things are what awaits Christians and non-Christians shortly before the time of the return of Christ. And so it turns into this book that that because it breeds confusion due to the weirdness of the book, due to how different it is from the other letters in the New Testament, and because it's a book that has promoted fear for some people, a fear of what's going to happen. Will they be left behind? Will they be one of the ones who'll suffer through the great time of the tribulation before Jesus returns? And because of these responses, that they just basically leave the book alone. They make statements like, you know, I know Jesus is going to return. That's all that matters. And so I really don't need to study this book. Or it turns into the opposite. It turns into an obsession for people. Websites are created. Again, more money is spent on books and lecture series that are talking about the book. And so we basically sit with the book of Revelation in one hand and the newspaper in the other, constantly trying to figure out when Jesus is going to return and what that time is going to look like and what's happening in Russia and China. Does it correlate with the events in biblical prophecy and what's happening with Israel today since 1948? How do we view all these things? And instead of getting the application out of the book, we turn the book into a roadmap of the future. We turn the book into a curiosity more than it is something that was really meant to be highly encouraging and highly impactful for the church of all generations, but of course, starting out with the church of the first century that it was written to. So what I want to do in this introduction to the book is I want to give you three main keys to understanding the book of Revelation. That if we want to unlock this book, and for some of us it really is a locked treasure, it's mysterious. How do we unlock those? Then I'm going to give you three things that we have to understand and we have to look at in order to decide what we think this book means. They're almost, they're in some ways they're doors, two different doors that we can go through these keys. Some people would say them as two different roads we can travel down. That how we make a decision on these doors or on these roads will determine our ultimate view of the book of Revelation. The very first key to unlock the book is understanding the type of literature that we're dealing with in the book of Revelation. And this will kind of determine the two roads that we'll travel down. Do we think that this book is mostly literal, or do we think that this book is mostly symbolic? Right? And we'll discuss exactly what that means. Just because I say the word symbolic does not mean that there isn't something literal to it. It's just the literal nature of the book is underneath the symbolism of the book. So do we take this book as mostly literal, or do we take this book as symbolic? The key to unlocking that door or the roadmap to decide whether we turn right or left is in the type of literature that we're dealing with. Now, there's no doubt that as we look at this book, it's also a letter. Just like the letters of Paul, the letters of Peter, and the other letters of John, we see that John writes this particular letter to seven churches. In chapter 1, verse 4, he says, John, to the seven churches that are in Asia. And as we get into the rest of chapters 2 and chapters 3, we'll see that he lists out seven specific real historical churches that existed during the first century. And he talks about different things that are going on in the churches, and he discusses some of the things that Jesus has to say to them as far as encouragements and also as warnings. So as we look at the book, yes, is it an epistle? Is it another letter? It is. But as we discussed earlier, the symbolism and for some people the weirdness comes out of the book, because not only is it an epistle, but it's like another book of the prophets. You know, we're just not used to that in the New Testament. As we look at the Old Testament, we see the four major prophets, the 12 minor prophets, and we know that it's a totally different type of literature, and we read it as such. We find poetry in it. We find visions. We find analogies and allegories. We find this beautiful way that God communicated with his people in Old Testament times. And so we're more comfortable with it there, even though we don't always understand the prophets either, but we can kind of at least lump them together. And this epistle that John writes, really, John, in many ways, writes it in the role of a prophet. So not only do we have an epistle, but we almost have the only prophetic book as far as the majority of its content. There are other prophetic type of things in other books in the New Testament, predictive or otherwise, but it's as far as the main heart of the book, we see a prophet of the New Testament in the book of Revelation. But when we look into prophecy, there are different kind of subgenres inside of prophecy. And one of those subgenres is one we call apocalyptic literature. Revelation 1:1, again, gives us the title of this book that we have, The Revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things that must soon take place. And this word revelation, we've come to just think of it as the title of the book. And if we think of the English word revelation, we think of revealed, something that is made known, which is stated later in this particular verse, that this is the time of the end that was made known through Jesus, again, through the angels, to John, and now to us in the church. But really, when you think about that word revelation, and you do a little study into it, the Greek word that John actually uses here that is translated revelation in the English is the same Greek word that we get the word apocalypse from. Right? So it's an apocalypsis. Now, you may have different things pop up into your head when I say the word apocalypse. Most of us would think of, again, the time of the end, a time of great war and all kinds of things that happen shortly before Jesus Christ returns. But in the first century, right, in the first century, when John uses this Greek term, apocalypsis, or apocalypse, the apocalypse of Jesus Christ, then the original audience of the first century would think of a whole different type of literature that was flourishing and popular during that time period. From about, I would say, about 200 BC, so 200 years before Jesus, to about 100 AD, right around the time period that this book is actually being written, this letter, this prophet, this apocalypse is being written, apocalyptic literature flourished in this area of Palestine, on down in towards northern Egypt, and amongst the kind of Jewish audience and Gentile audience that this book finds. Now, we have gone kind of backwards, just like we call the Gospels, and we've kind of talked about in the New Testament that there is a specific type of literature called a gospel, and we define that and we talk about it as we're looking backwards. Well, it's the same thing. As we're looking backwards onto this 300 years of history, we analyze this specific genre of literature, and we've called it apocalyptic, and we've said that certain things actually are held in common when we're dealing with apocalyptic literature. And when you look at those things that hold apocalyptic literature together, what we'll find is that we'll see these things in the book of Revelation. So as John writes this letter, he writes it in an apocalyptic style, which the original audience would have understood the different things that made that up. Now, we aren't really using apocalyptic literature anymore. It's kind of like saying, you know, when you go out, you want a good mystery novel, right? And everybody kind of knows what a mystery novel is because it's a genre of literature today. It's going to have a general, it's a plot and characters. There's going to be a murder or some type of mystery or a crime. And then throughout the book, you're kind of led to believe that different characters committed that crime, and you're trying to figure out what really happened. And at the end of the book, you have generally some type of revelation. You have some kind of plot twist where you find out who actually did the crime. And we understand what a mystery novel is. Well, we don't always understand what an apocalyptic literature is, what an apocalypse is from John's day. So let's look at some of the things, the similarities, some of the things that kind of define what an apocalypse was to John and his original audience, because they would go out and not get a mystery novel. They'd get the latest apocalypse. For instance, the first thing that we know about apocalyptic literature is that the general vehicle is the vehicle of a vision. That apocalyptic literature was full of these visions that the prophet or that the writer had. And in these visions, he's shown certain things. He's shown times of the end. He's shown these cataclysmic battles. He's shown angelic and demonic forces. And as we think about that, as he goes through these different visions, then we have to understand, well, how do we understand visions? Well, our Western minds, our scientific observation likes to just kind of pick through literature and just, again, go kind of verse by verse and pick certain things out of it. But what we need to understand is that a vision is an art form. When you look at the Old Testament prophets, when you look at Ezekiel in particular, he had visions of the throne of God and the vision of the valley of dry bones. The point was not to give a bunch of details. It wasn't to give some kind of scientific A, B, C, D. It was the whole thing. It's a piece of art. We don't go up to a painting, a beautiful painting that we see, and go up and analyze every minute detail. We don't get like basically an inch away from the picture and look at one shade within, you know, one part of the picture in order to understand the whole picture. Right? The first thing we're going to do is we're going to stand back. We're going to stand back several feet. We're going to look at the picture and we're going to try to appreciate the whole thing that the artist was trying to encompass in his work. And we'll say, I get the whole big picture of this work, that the emotion that he's trying to give, the scene that he's trying to portray. Maybe later we'll go up and look at the different ways that he used colors or she used shading or perspective. But you'll never understand a painting with your face right next to it. You've got to stand back. And the same thing is true about the book of Revelation. Because it's an apocalypse, it uses visions. And so what we're going to have to do first is just kind of stand back and see this book. You know, there's some amazing artwork that's been done by Christian artists over the years of the book of Revelation. And the first thing I would always encourage people to do is go check that artwork out, whether it's in an entire book, illustrations done on Revelation, or whether it's just kind of searching through the web and seeing different pictures that people have painted and made to give them a better sense of seeing this book. That in order to really catch the big picture and the emotion, don't pick apart the details right off. Try to see what John is seeing. Try to put yourself in John's place. And instead of, you know, again, getting too detail-oriented, try to understand the emotion that these visions evoked, seeing Jesus coming down on this white horse, seeing this doorway opened up in heaven, seeing these multifaceted creatures, the living creatures around the throne of God. Instead of first starting and debating what the eyeballs are, what the different faces mean, just try to get the overall impact of seeing these things. Right? So Revelation is a book that we really have to try to see. The second aspect of apocalyptic literature is that there's generally an angelic guide. There's some type of angel or a guide that takes the host or the author or the prophet through these different visions. And along the way, this angel will oftentimes explain what certain things mean. And we have this as well in the book of Revelation. Like a true apocalypse, we see angels appearing throughout the book. And many times they ask John questions, to which he gives the sage reply, "I have no idea what I've just seen." And the angel then will give him some type of explanation. So we need to pay close attention to the angelic interpretation because it's coming from God. And God is speaking through these angels and telling the Apostle John, he's telling him what exactly he's seeing. He gives him an interpretation. And once there's an angelic interpretation, that is the interpretation. We can't go off and say, well, no, it really means this, or it, you know, it meant that for John's day, but it doesn't mean that anymore. Once we have an interpretation that comes from inside the book, you know, through Jesus, a God, or these angels, we need to have that as the established meaning of the book. The third thing, and this is going to be absolutely important, vital to understanding the book of Revelation, is that apocalyptic literature is full of symbols. Right? It's full of symbols, rich symbols. And these symbols were understood by the people of that day. Now, we are used to the fact that we have symbolism within our lives. For instance, the number 13. Now, the number 13, for most of us in a Western setting, would mean bad luck. If I asked you, again, what does the number 13 mean? It's bad luck. And here is where symbolism is such a tricky thing. Because symbolism is bound by culture, and it's determined, again, by time. So over different cultures, in one time period, numbers and colors and visions and animals can all be used as symbols, but used differently. If I were to go into a Chinese culture and say, what does the number 13 mean? They would say it's the number after 12, the number before 14. It doesn't have any meaning. But if I asked them what the number 4 means, they would tell me it's the number of death, of chaos, and generally a number that they would say means bad luck. So just in one time period, symbols can mean different things over different cultures. But add to that the challenge that we're trying to go back 2,000 years now. So there's a separation of time. And what certain numbers meant, what certain colors, what certain objects meant in that time period, we're going to have to do some research because they all understood it. And John, and Jesus speaking through John, takes it for granted that the original audience, these seven churches of Asia Minor, all have a basic understanding of common symbolism that's used throughout their culture. Common symbolism that would unlock, basically, the book to them. And so just as apocalyptic literature is full of symbolism, so is the book of Revelation, and we would all agree upon that. As people are looking through this book, there's certain things that everybody would say are meant to be interpreted symbolically in the book. For instance, the seven spirits, the seven lampstands, the seven stars, how Jesus is described as the Son of Man. Right? Most people don't think he literally has a sword coming out of his mouth. Most people literally don't think that Jesus has tattoos running down his leg. Let's say King of Kings and Lord of Lords. They take that as symbolic. Okay, most people feel, again, this description of the hidden manna, white robes, the key of David, spitting a church out of his mouth, the Lion of Judah, the slaughtered lamb, the seven horns, the four horsemen, the seal on God's servants' foreheads, the bowls of incense, the plague of locusts, the measuring of the temple, the two olive trees, the beast from the pit, the woman and the dragon, the beast of the sea, the beast of the land who's called the false prophet, the number of the beast, the bowls and the trumpets, Babylon, the great harvest. I could go on and on and on. All of these, pretty much a majority of the church, as they read through Revelation, would say these are symbols. We don't literally think that there's going to be, shortly before Jesus returns, a dragon that's going to come down to earth. We don't believe that there's going to be a multi-headed beast that will rise out of the ocean with one head that has been wounded. Right? We don't think that there'll be a great whore who will sit on top of the beast and drink the blood of the saints. We would say that these are symbolic, right? Now, again, we have to define what does that mean. A symbol, right, is, again, an image, an object, a color, or a number that stands for something else, just like 13 stands for bad luck, right? So we see these colors and these numbers within Revelation and these objects were understood as standing for something else. Right? So we would all agree that there's symbolism in the book, but also that there's something literal behind the symbol. Right? We may not agree on who the whore of Babylon is in chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation, but we would all agree that it's symbolic. Right? We may not all agree on what the beast coming out of the sea is in chapter 13, or on what the dragon is, or the false prophet, the beast of the land. We may not agree on what those are, but we'll all agree that those are symbolic. So clearly we've stepped into this different type of literature. We're not going now with the general rule of thumb that we try to take something literal, and if we can't take it literal, or if there's signs or clues within the text, then we should take that symbolically, or figuratively, if you will. Right? That's our general rule of thumb as we go through the stories of the Old and the New Testament, the narratives. And it's also our general rule of thumb as we go through the letters of the New Testament. And even though, again, we've said Revelation is a letter, it's different. It's a prophet, and not only a prophet, but the subgenre of apocalyptic. So our general rule of thumb should be, as we go through Revelation, to take things symbolically. And if we can't take them symbolically, if there's a clue inside the text, then we should take them literally. And so I find it highly interesting that a bulk of the book, the church has agreed, is symbolic. Even if they disagree what the symbol stands for, they say it is symbolic. However, when it comes to the numbers, right, and the time periods in the book, suddenly everybody wants to take those literally. Whether it's the 144,000 that we see described, whether it's the 42 months, also described as, again, a time and half a time, this 3.5 years that seems to be discussed throughout the book, the two witnesses in chapter 11, the final battle in chapter 16. There's some things within the book that, even though we're saying everything else is symbolic, we'll pick out particularly the numbers, right, and the dates, the time periods given, and say, no, those have to be literal. Because we're used to numbers, we're used to dates, and we think, again, instantly that those must be literal. Right? So as we go through the book, what we need to do is continue to interpret the symbols, first of all, not according to today, But what did it mean in the first century? Right? For instance, there's no way you can get away from the fact that the number 7 is significant in this book. It's mentioned time and time and time again. But what did 7 mean symbolically in the time that John is writing this? What did 7 mean symbolically? Right? What did a beast with many horns, again, what did it stand for? Not today, right? But what did it mean to them in the first century? And then we'll be able to take it into a modern context. The next part of apocalyptic literature is that apocalyptic literature is what we call dualistic. Right? Apocalyptic literature is what we call dualistic. And what we mean by that is it's very clear who is good and very clear who is evil. Right? There's no gray people in the book of Revelation. Have you noticed that? They're either the inhabitants of the earth or they're the inhabitants of heaven. Either you're on Jesus' side and so you have the mark on your forehead, or you're on the side of the beast and you have the mark of the beast on your forehead. Either you are buying and selling with the beast and his evil, or you are singing the song of Jesus, the song of the Lamb that no one else can sing. Either you, again, are going into the lake of fire, or you are going into the new heavens, the new earth, the new Zion at the end of the book. It's just that black and white. And in apocalyptic literature, it was always the titanic struggle between good and evil, between angels and demons, between God and Satan, that's being described. And it's the same thing in Revelation. It is black and white. And so we need to see those great contrasts. Just like we have the true Trinity, we have the seven spirits, which is the Holy Spirit. We have God the Father, the Almighty. And we have the Son of Man. We have Jesus. But then we have the counterfeit Trinity. We have the dragon, who is Satan. We have the beast coming up out of the ocean. And we have the beast coming up from the land. Just like we have the true woman of God in chapter 12. Just so we have the counterfeit woman of God, the great whore of Babylon in chapter 17. And so it'll really help us to understand again that John, as he looks at this, and Jesus as he's pouring this out, it's a very black and white, good and evil type of thing that we see in the book of Revelation. Another aspect of apocalyptic literature, and one of the reasons that it was so popular during this time of 200 BC to 100 AD, is that apocalyptic literature is usually written during a time of great persecution. Now, apocalyptic literature is something that didn't just kind of start in 200 BC out of nowhere. But what we really see are the strains, the foundations, the roots of apocalyptic literature going all the way back into the Old Testament. In fact, if you look at the book of Zechariah and Ezekiel and Daniel, particularly those last six chapters, you'll find that all three of those are heavily flavored with apocalyptic, prophetic type of characteristics, visions and symbolism, the great battle of the time of the end, the return of the kingdom of God in full power. All of those really have their threads going through those prophets of the Old Testament. And even when you look at Isaiah, you'll see some kind of mini apocalypses in his book as he ends the beginning cycles, and particularly you see it in the end of his book, kind of sprinkled throughout, this sense of the apocalyptic, of the final time of gathering at the mountain of God and gathering there again at the new city, as Ezekiel would call it. And so in that way, you see that this apocalyptic literature really has its roots in the Old Testament. And so when this great time of persecution happened, right, to the Jews, particularly by the Greek Empire, they responded in a similar way. And that's what we really see with those prophets I just mentioned out of the Old Testament. Ezekiel and Daniel, both writing during the time of the Babylonian exile, time of huge suffering for the Jews. And in the response, as a time when people are so concerned, when there's insecurity, when there's suffering, people really want to know, again, will God ever intervene into history? Will he stop these evil kingdoms and empires from succeeding? Will he finally come and rescue us, his people? Again, will history just go on and on and on like this? And apocalyptic literature says no. It says God will intervene. God is going to come and bring his kingdom. And in Revelation, it's Jesus, again, coming on the white horse. And he will defeat evil for all time. That history doesn't just keep going on. The Greeks had this view that history was cyclical. And even though obviously there are patterns within history, they really didn't see an end to it. But here we see in apocalyptic literature, history will come to a close as we know it. God will intervene with his kingdom and encourage Daniel and Ezekiel in the exilic time, or to encourage the people of Isaiah's day who are under the evil king Manasseh and Ahaz, or to encourage again the people who had just come out of the exile in the time of Zechariah. We see the same thing God doing in the book of Revelation. Because as we'll talk about when we review the background of the seven churches as we go through those particular chapters, there is rampant persecution going on in the Roman Empire as this letter is written. And whether we place it in the time period of Nero, or whether we place it again a little bit later after him in the time period of Vespasian, or we place it where it has been historically in church in the time of Domitian, they were all time periods marked by persecution, social persecution, physical persecution, and even persecution that was coming in waves from the Roman Empire. And so apocalyptic literature and Revelation was meant to be an encouragement. And here's the great tragedy that we started off talking about, that if this book, right, was meant to bring encouragement to the persecuted saints, and what ends up happening is that we take fear out of the book, that fear is our reaction to Jesus's return in the book of Revelation, then we have really missed the heart intent of this particular book and what it was meant to do. Right? Finally, there are some parts of apocalyptic literature, right, that don't really, again, line up with the book of Revelation. And those particular aspects of them have more to do with the authorship issues of the book. And that is that these apocalypses that were written between 200 and 100 were generally ascribed to some type of historical figure, some type of prophet, or someone who the Jews would have been familiar with and revered as a man or of God, or a person of visions. For instance, one of the most popular apocalyptic works of this time is called the Book of Enoch. We even get a quote in the Book of Jude from the Book of Enoch, even though it wasn't considered authoritative by the Jews and not by the early church either. It was still something that was widely read. And the Book of Enoch, which there's four parts of it, again, display this battle between the good angels and the bad angels, between God and Satan, who's called Belial in that book, and kind of attempts to unfold all of the future events as the kingdom of God will finally come and crush the forces of evil. And so, again, taking its name from Enoch, who in the book of Genesis walked with God, pleased God, and was no more, and is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11. Now, again, most scholars would clearly say that Enoch had nothing to do with the writing of this book, but they ascribe that authorship. Okay, we don't have certain things like that as we look through this book, because this book is clearly claimed by John in chapter 1, verse 4. And historically, and I would agree, we're talking about John the Apostle, right? John, who was part of that inner core of Jesus' disciples, as the author of this book of Revelation. All right, so our first key, are we dealing with a book that's symbolic or a book that is mostly literal? And I feel like we've established through looking at the type of literature as an apocalypse that, yes, the book is mostly symbolic. Therefore, as we go through this book, we need to understand, what does the symbolism mean? We need to take it symbolically. But again, we need to understand that there's something literal underneath it. Even if we disagree on the symbolism, symbolism doesn't take away the meaning of the book. We're not talking about the idealist view of Revelation, in which basically Revelation is just the battle between good and evil, and there's basically nothing historical or literal or in the future that we can take from this book. I disagree with that highly. Right? Symbolism has something real beneath it. We just need to dig harder and go back 2,000 years and, you know, pull up some of these things from the Bible and understand what these colors, numbers, and objects stood for. The second key to understanding the book of Revelation has to do with the aspect of not only what type of literature that the book is, but do we really even understand how prophets work? Right? We said that obviously this is not just a letter, that it's a prophet, and that John is really acting in many ways as the classic Old Testament prophet as he gives out this vision that is being passed on, this revelation of Jesus that's being handed to him by angels and by Jesus, by basically then God himself. And what this is going to unlock, the two roads or the two doors that this is going to help us determine, is going to be, is this book mostly describing the past, the present for John's time, or the future? Right? The future for John, but also perhaps the future for us. Right? So this is going to be, again, another one of those, do we turn right, do we turn left? What key will actually help us understand this? Well, it's understanding what the old prophets did in the Old Testament. Now, most of us, when we hear the word prophecy and we think of a prophet, we instantly think the future. And so the futurist view of the book, which is very similar to the premillennial dispensational view of the book, is that most of the book of Revelation is describing the future even for us today. So particularly going from chapter 4 all the way to the end of the book, the futurist or the premillennial view, the dispensational view, is that all of that part of the book is solely describing a time of the future. The future not only for John, but the future for us. And in fact, really narrowly kind of describing the last 7 years that take place on earth before Jesus returns, and then, of course, the 1,000 years that he reigns on earth before the new heavens and the new earth come. So they look at the book and they say, no, the book really is mostly talking about the future. Then you get the complete opposite side of that in the historicist view, which is that the book of Revelation was completely describing the events of John's day. So they describe the events of Nero and Domitian, the Roman Empire, the persecution that the early church faced, but all of it has already been fulfilled. Some of the historicists even say that this book was in a way describing and predicting even the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So even that too was in the past. It's all been fulfilled already. And so there's really very little of Revelation that's still yet to be fulfilled at all. Right? So how do we understand this? How do we make this choice? Is it talking about the past? Right? The past for John? Is it talking about the present, just the present for John, but now in our past, or is it mostly the future, things that still yet to be fulfilled? Well, Old Testament prophets, again, it's our view and our understanding that prophecy is solely predictive, right? But predictive prophecy is only one part of what the Old Testament prophets did. As you look through particularly books like Jeremiah, and you think about the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah has all three of those time periods talked about because that's what he does as a prophet. The two main things that a prophet does is called foretelling and forthtelling. Now, forthtelling is basically talking about the present and the past from God's perspective. And a huge amount of the book of Jeremiah is basically God just speaking through Jeremiah about what's happening in the past, basically how God views the history of Israel and Judah, and very specifically how God views what is going on within Judah, within Israel, at that specific time that Jeremiah is prophesying. So it's about how they've broken the covenant. It's about all the ways they put their faith in foreign alliances and how they've turned away from God into idolatry. That as you look through the major and minor prophets, most of the content will have to do with how God feels about what's happening right in the day of the prophet. And so we have to dispel that first myth or notion, wrong concept in our head, that the prophets are only talking about the future, that they're only being predictive. And we have to realize that the prophets were mostly speaking out about the sin. That's why God was sending a prophet. He was trying to woo his people and warn them and encourage them to come back to the covenant, right? Because he was revealing the sins of the people at that current time. Right? Yes, a part of what the prophets do is what we call foretelling, telling about something before it happens. Predictive prophecy is what we term that. So yes, some parts of the prophets were also predictive. And if we're looking in the Old Testament, a huge part of their predictive prophecy was about the time of the exile, okay? 722 BC, the northern kingdom taken away by Assyria, 586 BC, when the southern kingdom is taken away by Babylon. Another huge block was predictive of the first coming, which again was in their future, but now is already fulfilled for us. And then another huge block of predictive prophecy was describing the second coming, right? Talking about the kingdom of God, the end of the world as we know it, right? So that's just one part of it. So as we look at the book of Revelation, if John is going to be acting as a true prophet, right, a true prophet, just like we see in the Old Testament, then we can go ahead and understand that Revelation is going to be describing some things perhaps from the past, right, how God has viewed the history, particularly of these seven churches, right, and how he's been working in his redemptive plan with Israel. There'll also be, again, some things that rely, that pertain to the present, and that a huge part of this book will have to tell John about what's happening with the churches. So we see that as we read through the seven churches, that God is revealing sins that are going on inside the church at that exact moment that John is writing this, that there has to be a response, that if we look at the book of Revelation and we say that pretty much a huge part of the book was not for John's day, it was not even perhaps for our day, but a time of the future, then what relevancy does it really have for the church of the first century? Were they just the caretakers? God just said, I'm going to speak these words out to the Apostle John, and then the early church basically has the responsibility of just preserving those words for the people of the 21st century or whatever century when I actually return. And it really won't help them understand the times they're living in, won't help them understand the great spiritual battle that they're in the midst of. It'll just encourage them in a very general way that at some time at the end, I will return, and at that time, this book will be helpful to understand those events which they see around them. And it just doesn't line up with everything we've seen in the other parts of the Bible. When other letters were written, right? And when other letters were written in the New Testament, it had something to do with the Church of Corinth right then, the Church of Galatia right then, the Church of Colossae right then. Now, of course, the truth that was given to these churches is timeless, that even though it was written to that original audience, that there's application for the church of all generations. And I would argue that just like the epistles, just like the prophets, the same thing has got to be true of Revelation. That even though this book was written to the early church and therefore has application in their day, it was also written for the church of all generations. And however we interpret it, it should have meaning to both audiences. Right? So that's how a prophet works. And so our second key to understanding the book has to say that, yes, some things in the book will deal with John's present day. Some things in the book will also deal with the future for John and also the future for us. Right? So where does that leave us? It leaves us with the final key, that I think helps us unlock the book, the final two doors that we have to choose from, the final two paths that we have to choose right or left, and that will determine how we think about this book called Revelation. And that key is the structure of the book. The structure of the book. Right? So let's review and kind of bring this, as we're bringing this to the last and final key. First major decision we have to make, again, is this book mostly symbolic or is this book mostly literal? And then how do we define those symbols? How do we look at them? And that'll choose one path or another of how we look at the book. The second key, again, is this book mostly talking about our future, or does this book also contain things that were relevant to John's day, which for us is now in the past, already fulfilled, so to speak? And that will take us down two different paths. This final key is talking about the structure. Is this book chronological? In other words, starting at chapter 1 and going all the way to the end of the book, are we to view this book, these events that are being predicted, as happening in chronological fashion? In other words, the events of chapter 4 and 5 happen, then the events of chapter 6 will happen, and 7, then 8 and 9, so on and so forth. Right? Because if we view it that way, we're going to see this unfolding, this prediction of the future, or again, this laying out of the time period, the church age, and the second coming, we'll see that, again, as just flowing, one event happening after another. Right? The other possibility is that as we look at the book, is the book cyclical? Right? Doesn't mean that there isn't chronology within those cycles, but that this book is actually cyclical, meaning John is going to take us through different cycles, different viewpoints or perspectives in order to show us, reveal to us, this time of the end and what we can expect and what the early church could expect as far as the time period leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, in order to do this, in order to really fully do that, you'll have to look at the book chapter by chapter and kind of look through the clues in the book in order to pull out the structure of the book. Now, we won't find the kind of structure that we see in the other epistles. In most of Paul's epistles, and even in the book of Hebrews and other places, we find that they clearly used a very simple topical structure of theology to application. They were used to kind of viewing that type of way that the author would put his book together. He put all his theology, all his concepts, ideas, thoughts about God in the first part of the book, and then he would end the book, as we see in Ephesians and Romans and other books, with the application, the practical, how do we walk these out, these thoughts and ideas in our everyday life. Right? That's kind of what we're used to, or at least, you know, a few topics. We're not going to find that kind of structure in Revelation. Yes, it might have been an epistle sent out to these churches, but we find no theology to application within the book. So as we look through the book, one of the things that I think will help us to see the structure is this thing I mentioned earlier, the use of the number 7. Now, again, as you go through the book, you're just hit with 7 after 7 after 7. And there's 7 stars, and there's 7 churches, and there's 7 lampstands, right? There's 7 bowls, there's 7 trumpets, there's 7 seals. There are 7 times in which the phrase, again, all peoples, languages, tribes, and nations. There's 7 different blessings in the book. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the book. There's 7 calls for endurance. Now, here's a call for an endurance of the saints. There are 7 times that the phrase Lord God Almighty is used in the book. 7 times in which God is appearing on the throne. So there's no way we can get away from the number 7 in the book. What is it with the number 7? Well, we'll talk a little bit later about the symbolism of all the numbers that are used in the book, but we have to talk about 7 here. And it goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. That 7 symbolizes perfection, fulfillment, completeness. Just as God created in 6 days and then rested on the 7th, we call those the 7 days of creation. So from the very time of the book of Genesis and creation itself, God has used the number 7, right, to symbolize, whether literally or symbolically, completeness, right? It's done. It's finished. It's perfect. And that's the way we see it utilized throughout the Old Testament. When we think about Ezekiel and he talks about the judgment on the nations, Ezekiel picks 7 nations that he talks about that judgment coming upon. You see it again throughout the book of Revelation, and that's the sense that it's meant to give us. So as we look at those 7s, what we're going to find is that the book is actually structured according to 7s. Right? So we get the introduction, or what we term the prologue, in the opening chapter of the book. We get the vision of the Son of Man, but then shortly after that, we get our first series of 7s. We get the 7 churches, and that takes us through chapters 2 and chapter 3. After chapter 4 and 5, again, we're taken back to kind of a vision, and this time, a vision of the throne again. So the first vision we had of Jesus as the Son of Man, again, on the throne, he has the stars and the lampstands basically under his control. We have the 7 churches. Now we have a return to the throne of God and a picture of God on the throne, and then we have the vision of the Lamb. Soon after that, in chapter 6, we're back to another series of 7s. So we've had 7 churches. Now we have the 7 seals, right? After the time of the 7 seals, we're taken back to the throne room of heaven at the beginning of chapter 8, the end of chapter 7. And from the throne room again, we have another series of 7, this time the 7 trumpets. So we have a section on the 7 churches, a section on the 7 seals, and now a section on the 7 trumpets. And once again, at the end of the 7 trumpets, we are taken back to the very throne room of God at the end of chapter 11. Now, the thing we would expect, of course, if you're following where I'm going with this, is that we would have 7 sevens. We would have, again, 7 different cycles or series of 7s, that we would have the 7 churches, the 7 seals, the 7 trumpets, and then starting in chapter 12, we would have another series of 7s. Now, at this point, he doesn't list them out specifically, but as we go through the structure, one thing that I will point out later is that we actually have seven different portents or signs or visions that are laid out to us between chapters 12 and chapter 14. So I would actually say that we do actually have the next series of sevens after the seven trumpets. So we're taken back to the throne room again at the end of this series of sevens in chapter 15. Chapter 15, at the end of another series, we find ourselves at the throne of God. And so in chapter 16, our next series of seven. Seven bowls. We have the seven bowls of wrath. And this will take us up through the end of chapter 16. Now, that gives us, again, in review, the seven churches, the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven visions, and the seven bowls. Five series of sevens. If we could just see two more series of sevens, then we'd have seven series of sevens, and we would say, aha, that ultimately is the ultimate structure, the big picture, the way this group book is actually grouped together. And this is where there's a lot of disagreement on people who've studied the book and tried to lay out the structure. That some see, yes, two more series of sevens from chapter 17 all the way towards the end of the book. And then John, of course, closes the book in chapter 22 with an epilogue, a final closing, final blessings, again, final words of Jesus. As I have studied through here, just because there's so many different ways you could try to break this up, I see two more series, two more cycles, but I don't necessarily see them laid out in seven specific things each. What I see is in these two final series from whether we're dealing again with chapter 17 through 19, and then the final ultimate series to me, or cycle, is in chapter 20 and 21. So I see those two. They're basically, again, two last series that we have, or cycles that we have, and they're ultimately pictures, again, of final judgment. And that takes us towards the end of the book. So as we look at this book, we can't argue that the cycles, these series of sevens, are the way that Jesus gave John how this book was supposed to be structured. So what goes on within these series? That's our next question. Because if we can say what goes on in these series, we'll have to be able to say, all right, are these series of sevens all talking about the same thing? Are they talking about different things? Or are they, again, laid out chronologically? So they're all talking about separate events that happen in a chronological fashion, or perhaps that these series of sevens are somehow cyclical, somehow showing us the same thing, but yet from different perspectives. Right? And we'll look at that.